Hello, folks. Welcome to the September 2017 edition of First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. Over the course of the next 45 minutes or so, I'll be covering recent developments in public safety labor relations, the law of the workplace for police officers, firefighters, corrections officers, deputy sheriffs, anybody in the public safety family. I've got some cases that I want to talk about, but first of all, I've got a little bit of a news update, and then secondly, a little bit of a rant. I'm sorry. So, first of all, the news update. Just about an hour ago from when I'm recording this, President Trump nominated Cheryl Stanton to become the head of the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor. Why is that important? Well, it's the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor that writes all of the regulations that interpret and apply the Fair Labor Standards Act. We've seen how that can be very important for a lot of people. If you recall, back in 2004, under the Bush administration, the Wage and Hour Division rewrote the rules as to who is exempt under the FLSA, rewrote them in a way where the estimates were 8 million people lost their ability to collect overtime. Then we saw the entire situation switch under the Obama administration a couple of years ago when the same rules were rewritten to restore the overtime rights of those 8 million people and grant overtime rights to another, estimates are, 5 million people. All of these are, of course, political decisions, but they're political decisions that have significant ramifications in the workplace. The Wage and Hour Division discusses, for example, the standards for what's known as the Section 7K exemption under the FLSA, the exemption that covers police officers and law enforcement officers and firefighters. It talks about what's work, what's not work, is donning and doffing work, when do you begin to count work. For example, do you count 6 minutes of work or 8 minutes of work? It writes regulations that cover the full ambit of issues that arise under the FLSA. So the identity of the head of the Wage and Hour Division, and in particular, the political philosophies of that individual become very important. So who's Cheryl Stanton? And how is she likely to be on issues like, for example, expanding the overtime rights of relatively low-paid individuals? Where is she going to come down on that? Well, we don't know a lot about her yet, but there are some clues in her biography. And I'll give you these clues, and then we'll do a little bit of a test, and you can guess how she's going to come out on the issues. Stanton is currently the director of what's known as the South Carolina Department of Employment and Workforce. That's apparently a state agency that is essentially concerned with unemployment compensation claims. She sits on the board of the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce. She once served as a White House aide for the Bush administration, George W. Bush. She was the liaison to the Department of Labor, the NLRB, and the EEOC, and she was once a management side partner in the multi-state mega law firm known as Ogletree Deacons. It's a firm that was once described by the New York Times as, and I'm quoting, frequently cited by the AFL-CIO as a top union buster. So that's her background. From South Carolina, where she sits on a unemployment compensation board. She's on a board of directors for the Chamber of Commerce. She once served in the Bush administration and was a partner in a management side law firm that apparently is pretty aggressive in representing management. So how's she going to come down on these wage and hour issues? There's your test. I'll give you just a moment to think about it. Okay, that's enough time. In other words, if you're an employee, hold on to your hat. And if you are an employer, you're in for what you will think of as relief from rules of the Department of Labor. this is going to be, I'll predict, a wild ride. Next up, as I said, a little bit of a rant. I mean, what would these podcasts be without a little bit of a rant, right? Just me talking about the law, and that would bore even me. So here's what the rant's about. It's about two events that happened in the last couple of weeks, two events that got national press that left me thinking a lot about a fundamental issue that law enforcement officers are facing today. What are the two events? The first one came out of Georgia, where we had a Georgia police officer, I think he was a lieutenant, who told a woman that he had stopped, who apparently was nervous about him and giving him a bit of a hard time, told her something to the effect of, don't worry about it, we only shoot black people. And then the second event was what happened in Utah between a police officer and a nurse. You recall the police officer was at a hospital trying to get a blood sample from a person who apparently was a crime victim. He was actually trying to get the blood sample to help the victim in later litigation or later criminal proceedings. The nurse objected. And the officer apparently got his supervisor involved. His supervisor said, get the blood sample. The nurse got her supervisor involved. Her supervisor said, no, don't do it. Got on a speakerphone and apparently escalated the whole situation. And it ended with the officer temporarily arresting the nurse. Now, both of those officers are under investigation. The word is that the Georgia officer is going to be fired, and the officer in Utah, along with his partner who was on the scene, are on administrative leave pending investigations. What really struck me about these incidents was how prominently they were discussed in the national press. I look at Google News every day. Gotta say, it's probably my primary news source, reading it and the links that are in there that lead you largely to like the New York Times and the Washington Post and other major newspapers. The Utah story rose to a prominence position of number 3 on the news feed. The Georgia story ended up at number 4. I mean, look, these sort of chippy encounters, looking at the Utah case for a moment, these sorts of chippy encounters between medical professionals and law enforcement officers, all of whom were working under a high degree of stress, they happen all the time. And they don't always end with arrest. They rarely end with an arrest like that. But I've known ones that have ended even worse than this one ended. And yet, even though these interactions happen all the time, they're now prominent in the national news, and these stories will have an impact, albeit maybe a minuscule one. Maybe it'll just nudge the needle a little bit, but an impact on the image of police that is held by everybody who reads those stories. And that's what really got me to thinking. Unlike any other profession I know about, we judge police by, not by the good behavior of the vast, vast majority of police officers, but by the bad behavior exhibited by very, very few officers. Look, we have a population of over 800,000 police officers in this country. We're going to have police officers who do things wrong, who make mistakes. We're going to have police officers who slip through the cracks in what is, without doubt, the most rigorous hiring system for any profession that we have. That's going to happen. But unlike other professions, we don't judge police officers by the fact that they have over 1 million encounters with citizens every day and that 99.99% of them end routinely, even those that involve felony arrest. I can point to heroic actions of police officers. I can show videos of it until I'm blue in the face. and the public will want to judge officers by their perceptions of the exceptions. Those who make the mistakes, those who don't follow the rules, they want to judge by the exceptions, not by the behavior that the overwhelming majority of officers engage in on a day-to-day basis. And think about that for a moment. What if we made our national judgments about other professions in the same way? What if we judged doctors or lawyers or the military or nurses or pilots or social workers or whoever by the mistakes they make? Medical errors in this country are estimated by doctors to kill more than 250,000 people every year in this country. Do we judge doctors by those mistakes? No, we think of them as heroes. And what's got me a little bit depressed and on this rant is that I don't really see an end to this trajectory. I think this trajectory that we have of judging policing by the problems, I think this trajectory is actually only going to get worse, right? Because we've made the national decision to hang body cameras around the neck or put them on the shoulder of every police officer in this country. If you extend that trajectory 10 years out, who's going to want to become a police officer? Why would a decent young woman or young man opt for such a life? And what will the applicant pool look like then? If you think we have a recruiting crisis now, imagine what it's going to be 10 years from now. And this has been bothering me. You've heard me talk about that if you're a listener to this podcast. You've heard me talk about this in generalities for a couple of years, but it's really, I think, getting to the point of almost crisis in this country. And this is why I found another story that was out there about a week ago, so affirming and so invigorating. This story is about a group of large police unions on the West Coast, unions like those in Los Angeles and San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, Portland, Seattle, those sorts of unions. They have banded together to form something called the United Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. What's the mission of that organization? To change the national perception of police and to change it into a perception that is accurate, that focuses on what it is police officers do day in and day out that is so positive and so good for our communities. That, you know, the national dialogue about policing is going to happen one way or the other. It can only be influenced for the positive if police are involved in shaping that dialogue. Okay, rant over. Now on to some cases. And I want to start with a couple of smaller cases. I'd call them smaller cases, but they've got some important principles in them that come out of Florida. And then a major case that comes out of the Nevada Highway Patrol involving the limits of an employer's ability to regulate off-duty speech by public employees. And time willing, I've got a couple of other cases to talk about, but let's go to these Florida cases and talk about them. The first one is a case coming out of Broward County, Florida. And in Broward County, you have a bargaining unit of deputies and sergeants. They're represented by a group known as the International Union of Police Associations. There's a lot of them in Broward County. There's 1,300 of them. And believe it or not, the department doesn't provide firearms to its employees. I'll come back to that in a moment. But it doesn't provide firearms to deputies and sergeants. It requires them to carry firearms while on duty, and the department even encourages them to carry backup firearms. Instead of providing firearms, setup for a firearm, a duty firearm, magazines, holsters, night sights, everything like that, can cost more than $1,000. Instead of providing them, it has had since 1985 something called a loaner program. And what the loaner program is the sheriff loans deputies firearms, and these loans may last through their entire career, or they may last just a couple of years. Where do these guns come from? They come from a lot of different sources, including found property and donated firearms. And this is a system that has been in place, as I said, for well over 20 years. And then in 2016, the department decides to substantially end it. The department issues new rules that say, look, under the loaner program, we're only going to loan firearms to one type of deputy, a deputy who's been involved in a shooting, and during the time period when a deputy's personal firearm is inoperable, but only so long as repairs are being made. The new rules also required deputies who had loaner firearms to return them. Well, of course, this causes a great deal of consternation. The union, IUPA, files an unfair labor practice complaint and alleges that the change in the loaner program is a unilateral change in a mandatory subject of bargaining, something that can't be accomplished without the department first negotiating with the union. And that's the issue that goes to Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission. Is there an obligation to bargain over this, the essential termination of this loaner program? And if there is an obligation to bargain over it, what's the remedy in this case? And Florida's PERC finds that, in fact, this is a negotiable issue. I'm going to read you just a couple of sentences here from PERC's opinion. It says, there are a few things more fundamental to the relationship between the department and its deputies than whether the department will provide deputies with access to a duty firearm, and whether a deputy must spend his or her own money to purchase a fundamentally necessary piece of equipment for performance of required duties. PERC goes on to say, look, that means, because this is a mandatory subject of bargaining, employer, you can't unilaterally change it. What's the remedy? Restore the status quo. The commission goes on at some length talking about the normal remedy in one of these unilateral change cases, and ends up directing the department to, and I'm quoting, reestablish the firearms loaner policy in effect immediately prior to the unilateral change to that policy in 2016. Okay, I tell you the story of that case, which bluntly isn't really a surprising result, right? Equipment is generally thought to be a mandatory subject of bargaining. Safety equipment, even more so, a mandatory subject of bargaining. It's kind of surprising that this case even got to the level of a statewide labor board having to make this decision. I'm instead raising this case, not for the bargaining principle, but because of another reason. In large swaths of this country, firefighters and police officers have essentially stopped, bargaining about safety equipment. Why? They have instead relied on OSHA rules. Now, the federal OSHA statute, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the federal OSHA statute doesn't apply automatically to states and thus to cities and counties unless they adopt OSHA, but the majority of states have adopted OSHA or OSHA-type rules and have their own state safety agencies. And what you find in many of those states is that police and fire unions turn to their OSHA remedies under whatever state agency there is, rather than bargain about safety or equipment safety issues. Why? It's a pretty simple equation. If you're bargaining, let's take the Fort Lauderdale situation. If you're bargaining and you're raising the issue of whether or not the employer is going to buy guns, and it costs on the average $1,000 for the employer to buy and outfit a gun for a deputy, and you have 1,300 deputies, What you're talking about is an expenditure of $1.3 million, right? Wouldn't you expect the employer to want to take that expenditure into account in assessing the total compensation package that is produced as a result of negotiations? Sure. And the employer is probably going to say something to the employees like, all right, we'll pay for your guns, but in the meantime, you're going to get like 1% less in wages. You're going to have to pay $20 a month more in health care because we only have X amount available for total compensation. And if you take part of it in the form of the firearms purchase, well, there's less available for the rest of the pot. That's the way total compensation works. It's a give and take. But an employer's obligations under OSHA are unilateral. There's no give and take. An employer simply has an obligation to maintain a safe work site. And that means that if instead of bringing up the issue of firearms and bargaining, a union files an OSHA complaint saying, hey, firearm for a police officer is an essential piece of safety equipment, just like a protective mask is for a welder who uses an acetylene torch. Employer, you have an obligation to provide firearms to everybody. That means if a union raises that through OSHA, there's no give and take. The employer, if it's found to be in violation of the law, simply has to provide whatever that essential piece of safety equipment is. And I've seen this used in a wide variety of different contexts. I've seen it used with firearms, by the way, successfully for law enforcement officers. I've seen it used with respect to radio equipment that was failing. There's a rather notorious case in my home state of Oregon where Oregon State Troopers filed an OSHA complaint because there were too many dead zones on the radio. And by way of remedy, the state had to install a repeater system that actually came close to eliminating the dead zones on the troopers' radio system. Imagine how much that had to cost. And imagine if the troopers' union had had to bear the cost of that in the total compensation process and bargaining. Instead, filed an OSHA complaint. The result is got a new radio system without the give and take of collective bargaining. I've seen it happen with respect to protective vests. There's even this amazing case out of the state of Washington, city of Seattle, where you're going to have to hold on when you hear the facts of this case. This is one where you had a police officer, a motorcycle officer, who was not wearing a protective vest and who was shot in the torso. The police chief decided that this was the last time one of his officers was going to get shot and not be wearing a vest. And so what the police chief did is he kind of made this incredible calculus. He thought, look, I can go ahead and impose a requirement that all officers wear vests. The union then will be forced to decide whether or not it wants to bargain over that issue because it's a mandatory subject to bargaining. The union will be torn up because some officers won't want to wear vests, other officers will want to wear vests, other officers will not only want to wear vests, but will want those officers who are not wearing vests to wear vests. The union's going to be torn up. It's all going to be a mess. I'm going to file an OSHA complaint against myself. And that's what the police chief did. He filed a workplace safety complaint with what's known as WSHA, which is Washington's safety agency. And the complaint said, I am violating my obligation as a police chief to provide a safe working environment for all my officers by not requiring them to wear vests. And the state safety agency agreed with him and found that he was and ordered him to provide vests for all of his employees. I have never seen a case where an employer filed a safety complaint against itself, but it did, and the chief won, or he lost, or whatever happened in that case. So that's why this Florida case, that's why this Broward County case actually surprised me to see it. Because in other parts of the country, you don't see these sorts of disputes arising in the bargaining context anymore. You see them arising in the context of state safety complaints. All right, now let's turn to the other Florida case. Again, kind of a small issue, and I just want to raise this one because it's something that comes up with regularity, and it's worth emphasizing. And the question is, what if a union violates its own bylaws or its own constitution? Is that an unfair labor practice complaint? Is that a breach of the duty of fair representation? And this is another case that Florida's PERC decided in the last month or so. So this is a case involving three members of Lodge 129 of the Fraternal Order of Police. That lodge represents police officers in the city of Ocala. And these three officers file an unfair labor practice complaint with Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission. And here's what they say happened. They say, we gave testimony in the city's investigation of alleged misconduct by other officers. And when we did that, when we testified, another member of the lodge, another officer, filed a complaint with the lodge. And the complaint that was filed said that by participating in the city's investigation, we engaged in misconduct in violation of the union's constitution or bylaws. It's not too many details in this opinion, so I'm not exactly sure how that would be a violation of the constitution and bylaws, but let's accept it as a given. These three officers also say in their complaint they filed with PERC that Lodge 129 launched an investigation, suspended the officer's membership while the investigation was ongoing, and that a membership committee subsequently notified the officers that it had voted to, and the phrase is, indict them on charges of violation of the union's constitution and bylaws, and that a trial board hearing was scheduled. The three officers then promptly resigned from Lodge 129. Florida's a right-to-work state, so you don't have to be a member of the union there if you're in the bargaining unit. So the three officers resign, file their unfair labor practice complaint, and say that the union's bylaws denied us of our fair representation rights by denying us of the right to a fair and equitable grievance procedure where we could challenge what the union is trying to do by indict us. This whole thing under Florida's system goes to PERC's general counsel, and the general counsel throws out the unfair labor practice charge. And he throws it out for the same reason that labor boards all over the country have thrown out claims that a breach of a union's bylaws amounts to a breach of the duty of fair representation. Here I'm going to read you a couple or maybe three sentences from the general counsel's opinion that will explain the rationale. Here's what the general counsel said. A union's duty of fair representation encompasses only matters which impact on the wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment of bargaining unit employees and doesn't attach to matters that are internal union affairs. We have held that, absent some unlawful purpose, we will not interfere with the internal decisions of labor organizations concerning its membership. The manner in which the union resolves internal disputes, or whether it complies with its own constitution and bylaws, those aren't matters that are remediable through PERC's unfair labor practice procedure. And that, as I just mentioned, is a very standard ruling. So what does that mean about a union's constitution and bylaws? Are those provisions not enforceable? Well, no, it's not that they're not enforceable, but they're enforceable in a different place. The standard holding that you see is that a union's constitution and bylaws forms an implied contract between the union and its members. And that means that breaches of the Constitution and bylaws are thought to be addressed in the court system, not through filing an unfair labor practice complaint. Theoretically, a bylaws or constitution could have a mandatory arbitration clause. I've never seen that issue litigated, but I'm thinking it would be enforceable if it was there. But absent a mandatory internal arbitration clause, you address claims that a union has violated its bylaws in court, not through an unfair labor practice. And I will tell you, more than one employee who's wanted to sue their union has made this mistake and has later found out that the statute of limitations for filing in court have expired. Now on to that major case that I described horribly. It also involves a major. That major case that I decided involving described involving the Nevada Highway Patrol and free speech. This comes to us from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, so it has only direct applicability or binding power in that area covered by the Ninth Circuit, but I think the decision of this court is really standard First Amendment law, and it's likely to apply everywhere. So what happens? In 2011, Nevada Highway Patrol Major by the name of Kevin Tice sent an email to members of the patrol's canine drug interdiction program. And the email was in the wake of reorganization of the program, the drug interdiction program, and it established a new policy on when employees could make public comments about the program. And I've just got to read this to you because it's really important for you to understand how sweeping this is. Here's what Major Tice wrote. As we re-engage in canine and interdiction program oversight at the regional command level, it is important to ensure appropriate flow of communication. It is critical that we identify and resolve issues and inconsistencies that have developed since the current program's inception. Here it comes, drum roll, effective immediately, except for allied law enforcement agencies and high-intensity drug trafficking area representatives, there will be no, all in caps, direct contact between canine handlers or line employees with any, all caps, non-departmental and non-law enforcement entity, or persons for the purpose of discussing the Nevada Highway Patrol canine program or interdiction program, or direct and indirect logistics therein. In other words, don't talk to anybody about the canine program, anybody who's not involved in the canine program. Why the email? And this is what one of Tice's supervisors testified. He said, questions coming from the legislature and from the governor's office and from different sources with incomplete understandings of what's going on, those questions sparked Tice's email. And Tice himself later explained that the policy's intent, and I'm quoting, was to forbid direct contact with Friends for Canine representatives, that's a group, by the canine and interdiction employees. Tice described Friends for Canine as a private organization that was, and I'm quoting again, intentionally meddling into how the unit was run. Well, if you tell a bunch of police officers that they can't talk to anybody about their work, while they are off duty, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to get a free speech lawsuit, right? And that's what happened here. A group of canine officers contended that the policy violated their First Amendment rights, and that's the issue that ended up before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court strikes down the policy, finds that the policy is unconstitutionally, and the word that is used is overbroad. What's the overbreath doctrine? The overbreath doctrine is a First Amendment doctrine, and what it says is, if you're going to regulate speech, government, you've got to regulate it as narrowly as possible. You have to be careful that the scope of your regulation doesn't cover protected speech. You can only regulate that speech which the First Amendment allows you to regulate. You can't be overbroad in the way you regulate speech. And that, says the court, is the flaw with what Major Tice wrote. The court says, look, we understand that under the Supreme Court's decision in Garcetti versus Sabalos, that if a public employee is speaking as part of their job, that speech isn't entitled to constitutional protections. But that's not the end of the story. The court says, look, the critical question is whether the speech at issue is ordinarily within the scope of the employee's job duties, not whether the speech merely deals with those duties. In other words, is this speech the employee is employed to make? Or is it simply speech about their job? The Supreme Court has told us, and told us in a case involving a Georgia public employee, that the mere fact that speech concerns information obtained by virtue of public employment doesn't transform that speech into employee and therefore unprotected speech. It's still citizen and therefore protected speech. Now, what about Tice? What does the court say about Tice's email? And here, again, I'll read you a few sentences because the words the court chooses here, I think, are really important. Even if some speech implicated by Tice's email edict, by the way, if a court ever uses the word edict to describe what you did, you're going to lose, right? Okay, back to the court. Even if some speech implicated by Tice's email edict might fall within the trooper's official duties, much of the potentially affected speech does not. Tice's policy, drafted very broadly, could reasonably be understood to forbid, upon penalty of discipline, speech made by canine troopers in their capacities as citizens. On a straightforward reading of the sweeping language in the email, by the way, if a court says you use sweeping language, you're going to lose. On a straightforward reading of the language in the email, it is not confined to official agency business, nor to information that would harm pending investigations or expose sources or methods. Here comes the important part. The policy as enunciated encompasses employees' opinions about the program and also reaches legitimate whistleblower complaints about the program. So what the court is concerned with here is that where some of this speech could be regulated, potentially regulated, most of it, most off-duty criticism of how the canine program works, cannot be regulated by the employer without violating the employee's free speech rights. Let me give you the tagline in the court's opinion. The policy included in Tice's email seemingly applies not only to speech intended for the media, but also to speech directed to community groups, to city and state legislators, to state and federal officials, and even to family members and friends. Communications with individuals or entities outside of an employee's chain of command isn't pursuant to the employee's official duties. I think this is an important opinion because what it tells us is that employers who are creating media relations policies, policies that regulate when a public employee can speak to the media about anything that is work-related, have to be very careful that those policies don't constrain legitimate off-duty speech that is not made as part of the employee's job. They have to remember the Ninth Circuit's distinction here, which I think is absolutely a great one. The distinction between whether speech is part of the employee's job duties or whether the speech is simply about the employee's job. The first can be regulated, the second can't be, unless the speech is, of course, false or falls within some of the other exceptions to the First Amendment. The last case I want to talk about this month deals with a question that arises in a variety of contexts. What happens if you have a conflict between a statewide bargaining law and a local charter? And this is a question we've seen come up in so many different areas. We've seen it come up with, changes in pension systems, changes in grooming codes, just a wide variety of different contexts. Where it comes up here, and this is a case involving Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the police in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it comes up here in the context of residency. So rank and file police officers in Pittsburgh are represented by Lodge 1 of the FOP. And there's a provision in Lodge 1's contract, it's been there for a while, that says that if the Pennsylvania State Legislature enacts legislation related to residency for second-class cities, and that includes Pittsburgh, the parties could reopen the contract to bargain over residency. And the reopener clause included the right to seek binding arbitration if an agreement couldn't be reached. When the contract was signed, there was a state civil service law that required officers in second-class cities, like Pittsburgh, to be residents of the city. However, the legislature changed it after the contract went into effect. The states, it's known as the General Assembly there in Pennsylvania, repealed the residency mandate, replacing it with language that second-class citizens may require a police officer to become a bona fide resident as a condition of employment. So, of course, the moment that that happens, Lodge 1 of the FOP tries to reopen the contract. The parties meet and bargain. They can't reach an agreement. It goes to binding arbitration. And in Pennsylvania, you have what are called tripartite arbitration panels. A neutral arbitrator and then one arbitrator each appointed by management and labor. While the arbitration panel is pending, while the whole process is pending, the Pittsburgh City Council takes action. It passes a resolution to put a referendum on the upcoming general election ballot as to whether the city should be amended to require all city employees, including police and fire personnel, to maintain their domiciles within the city. Voters approved the Home Rule Charter Amendment on November 5th, 2013. But that arbitration is still pending. And the arbitration panel finally comes back with a decision 4 months later, in March of 2014, and it ruled that the city-only residency requirement would immediately discontinued and be replaced by an obligation that officers reside within a 25-air mile radius of the city-county building. The city files a court challenge to the arbitration panel's opinion, arguing that the panel has no jurisdiction to make a ruling on the issue of residency. And so there we go. There we've got the conflict, right? The arbitration panel's decision, which is issued pursuant to a state collective bargaining law, does that prevail, or does the voter-approved city charter amendment requiring residency prevail? And Pennsylvania Supreme Court says arbitration panel and state collective bargaining rights prevail. The court says, first of all, residency is clearly a mandatory subject of bargaining. It's within the scope of collective bargaining. We've ruled that way for years, so have states all over the country. And the court says, we agree with the FOP that the provision of authority to a municipality to take action with regard to a bargainable subject doesn't give the municipality the ability to place those subjects out of reach of an arbitration panel, even if the change is made by the employer through a voter-approved alteration of the charter. The court goes on to talk at some length about the fact that with the enactment of the collective bargaining law, it happened in Pennsylvania in 1968, with the passage of the collective bargaining law, the General Assembly, the legislature, decided that not only would police officers and firefighters and other public employees have the right to collectively bargain, but that there was a legitimate overriding concern at the state level that prompted the legislation. What's that overriding concern? The overriding concern is that of labor peace. Here's how the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ends its opinion. The Home Rule Charter provision requiring residency is at odds with an act of statewide application. There's a patent inconsistency between the collective bargaining law, which provides for bargaining over residency, and the Home Rule Charter provision that removes residency as the subject of bargaining. Accordingly, the Home Rule Charter provision violates the law. And the Supreme Court orders a trial court to affirm the arbitration panel decision, and now Pittsburgh police officers and firefighters have a 25, or police officers, I don't know what's going on with the firefighters now that I think about it, police officers have a 25-mile residency limitation, not a requirement that they live within the city. Pretty standard fare here that a statewide bargaining law prevails over contrary provisions in a local charter, but it's a good reminder. And with that, I want to thank you for listening to our podcast. We've got some upcoming seminars at LRIS that I hope you check out. In particular, we have one that's coming up in a couple of weeks in Las Vegas on grievances and collective bargaining, and then another in November that is police-oriented that deals with critical incidents and internal affairs investigations. Come to our website, LRIS.com, to check that out. We've also got a special podcast interview that we're going to be publishing in a couple of weeks. And that's an interview that I did with a professor at Indiana University, School of Business in Indiana University, talking about the impact of sleep deprivation on supervisor-subordinate relationships. It was a fascinating interview. He's got a really interesting research going on, and some of that research, I'll bet, will surprise you. And with that, thanks for listening. This is Will Aitchison signing off.